Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Cyber Coast to Coast. This is one of your co-hosts, Craig, here. I am coming at you from the west coast of Costa Rica once again, the Tamarindo area. And I'm joined again by my brother, Scott. Hey, Scott, how's it going?
Hey, what's up there, Craig? Doing well, and I'm here in headquarters of Berkeley Varitronics, Metuchen, New Jersey, on the East Coast over here on a kind of a gloomy day, which is strange. We had a nice little heat wave for a while, and now it's kind of cooled off. It's about mid-70s or so here with a little bit of breeze and a little overcast, so it's kind of nice and pleasant.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wish we had a visual podcast because I would give a quick tour to our listeners and our viewers in that case, and you. We got a really sweet setup here. We moved into this place in Tamarindo. We got it for 1 month, and nice. Just 100 feet away from a beautiful beach, surfing, all that stuff. And we even have our own little gated in private pool, and
wow,
like a lot of extra rooms that we don't need. It's kind of crazy. Our own nice grill for cooking. And we even got our own outdoor shower when you come back to the beach and you're all sandy and do your feet and your bathing suit and all that stuff. So we're living it up here for now. Things could change though. We had a crazy storm here the other day. It was, I'll send you some video on it. It was like I was in it's like a kind of a strip mall, but it's covered. And things were blowing over. Everyone had their phones out. They were recording it because it was like a serious flash flood, lasted about a half an hour, and then it rained for another 3 hours after that. Like I had to drive home from shopping. We were driving to a foot of water, and the cabbie, the guy, the Uber driver, he just kept saying, like, he's like, this is crazy, but that's the wet season here. It's something, the entire town was flooded, so.
That's crazy, man.
Yeah, but then the sun is also so intense here. By the next day, it was dry. Everything was dry and the water was all gone. You'd never know that it rained because it just evaporates everything and the water runs off and disappears. So,
wow. That's kind of neat, though. I guess it's nice. It reminds me of Florida a little bit. You'll get like a passing storm at a certain point. It gets real hot, then a passing storm, then it cools off a little. And interesting. Mm-hmm. Huh.
Yeah, crazy, crazy weather systems we're getting used to here. But whatever. In any case, let's get to the show.
Let's dive in.
Yeah, we got three solid stories today. First one's about a big data breach, another U.S. government data breach. We'll give you all the details on that. We got another one coming out of Hacker News, one about the SEC, this is more about a kind of a reveal, a transparency for companies that were attacked and when they should reveal it. So we'll go through some of those details and step people through. And third story, this one's more about the law enforcement buying data brokers, data from data brokers on people. It's kind of a workaround how they get around the constitutional amendment of privacy and all those things. So we'll step into those details as well. But first, let's just do a quick mention. We've been doing this segment on AirTag related news and things for a few weeks now. And this one isn't so much news because I've seen this pop up before, but I just thought it was interesting because we're seeing an increase now of parents using AirTags to keep track of their kids. I remember a couple years ago, well, if people want to go to read the story, you can see it all over because a lot of people are talking about this, but insider.com, and we'll have the link in the show notes. But I remember a couple of years back when the Apple Watch was introduced and you had parents saying, well, I'm not going to buy my kid a phone, but I'll get him a watch. That way I can track the watch and maybe do some kind of crude communication with them too if they have Wi-Fi or something, like get them a cellular watch and that kind of thing. Now they're kind of stepping way down to AirTags and just saying like, well, I could put it, I guess I could slip it in my child's backpack or something. And while I'm tracking their bag, I'm also tracking them. So, what's the harm? don't know, Scott, you're a parent. Did you ever, you know, what do you think about this stuff?
Well, it's funny you mention it, because it literally, something similar crossed my mind, not exactly with an AirTag per se, but we were just watching TV downstairs and it was late last night. And my son says, just wanted to hang out. Some people are hanging outside the house out front. We're on a cul-de-sac, quiet neighborhood. We know all the neighbors, so it's fairly friendly and all. And he went out and he was out for a while and he said, we're just going to take a walk. And my paranoid mind says, oh no, what happens if something happens? I said, oh, make sure you're careful. Do you have your phone on you? Yes, this and that. And what did I think about was, well, if there is a problem, at least I can look down on the Find My app and see where his phone is, where he's at, and, you know, help him if there's trouble. But I could see why parents would, maybe for younger children, especially in elementary school or something like that, with a backpack and all the craziness in this world, would want to just drop a tag in, because it's a lot cheaper than having a phone and subscription, and, you know, they lose the phone or this or that. An AirTag is simple. Drop it in and you have peace of mind. It's worth the $30 for an AirTag or whatever it is, and how simple it is in the ecosystem of Apple. So I think it's a brilliant idea. I guess if I understood right, this article is kind of showing a little bit of the negative side, how it kind of maybe conditions children to think differently about security and parents' relationship on spying on them and some other things like that. Could it actually hindering, I think is the term they use, the development of a child, a story like this was talking about. And I don't see how that could exactly happen. I guess if the parent's paranoid and needs to check in every 5 seconds, but those type of parents do that with a cell phone anyway. They're constantly right. Calling their kids, text me when you're here, there. And as a parent, I do that a little bit, I guess, but it's more, you know, hey, if you need anything, holler, or, you know, shoot me a text or ask a question. But we're not constantly monitoring our phone and watching their every move and tracking them and trying to figure. You have to have a level of trust. It's earned. And I think that's probably a balancing act from child to child, because some of you probably can't trust and they won't tell you where they're going and they're doing things behind your back. Then I could see why parents would be paranoid. So it's definitely a fine line, but I try to look at it. It's a positive tool that parents can use, the tracking tags and things. But at the same time, are they transparent? Do they tell their kids? I mean, I don't hide tags in my kids' stuff and track them without them knowing it.
Right.
I, if we're on the Find My network, I said, hey, you could see my phone. You know where I am at all times. You know where Dad is, and vice versa. We all watch and see one another if there's a problem and help one another. That's okay, I think.
Right. So, you make an agreement. You've all got nothing to hide. So why not, just for safety's sake, in case something does happen unexpectedly, it is good to be able to keep track of it. And it, like you brought up a good point too. You know, these kind of helicopter parents, they call them, you know, because they're always hovering over their kids and constantly pinging them and seeing what they're doing. You know, that you can track your child's whereabouts with an AirTag, but you're not really tracking anything important, which is their emotional state. You know, when you can see the metric, when they have a phone, and I'm not, you know, saying that all 5-year-olds should get their own phone or anything. But when younger children have phones, you get a lot more metrics than just their whereabouts. You can see what apps they're doing. You know how much time they're on the phone, and you could kind of, you know, determine their emotional state or something because you can talk to them or send them a text, or you, like I said, you just know how much time they're spending on the phone. Whereas, you know, an AirTag, it's just like, okay, they're here. They said they were going to be here, and it looks like they're here instead. So they lied to me, and then it seems like more of a way to enforce a punishment, or almost a form of entrapment in a sense, if they, you know, they agree to it and now they're kind of walking into it. And some parents feel the need, you know, their kids are delinquents, who knows, maybe they want that, but I don't think it doesn't seem like a good thing for just, you know, the broad spectrum of kids out there, because it's kind of a limited, very cheap tool. It's it could be harmless, and it's definitely comes in handy, especially if you go somewhere as a family, a group, like an amusement park, and then you split up, and then you come, you know, you say, oh, we're going to meet here, and oh, there they are, you know, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's a case. It's like everything else, you know, it's a case by case basis. If you trust your kid enough to use a phone, great. If you trust them enough to use a watch, great. If you trust them enough to just have the AirTag, that's fine too. But there has to be that, there has to be that trust and that communication between the parent and the child, I think, to make it truly, you know, effective tool.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree there. If it helps for other parents listening into this, what did help me sell it, I guess you could say. So my kids understood. I did say, hey, look, as part of the family share, the plan that's under Apple, since we all have iPhones and watches and the laptops and the, you know, we have AirTags and other things tracking some of our stuff if we travel. I said, with the family share, you also have access, because we have a plan with the music. It's tied into the Apple TV. So if you want to see a movie and you'd listen to it on your AirPods and so on and so forth. So it becomes part of that whole ecosystem. They're part of it and they have access. They want to hear a song or a certain music genre in the car, they just tune daddy out and they could listen to that, and that, mm-hmm. that's fine for them. And, but what comes with that is kind of the knowledge that, hey, we are tracking one another and looking out for one another. That's how I kind of sold it, I guess.
And speaking of, tracking and tools, I noticed we just began to ship our Bluetooth Lite, which is an AirTag tracker of sorts. And you had someone reach out to you on LinkedIn. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, actually, it's timely. It just happened today. And you're right. We just started in the past a little more than a week. We started shipping our first wave of Bluetooth Lite product. We had the Kickstarter back in February or whatever. Great success and response, great feedback. We've since been adding so many features. It's the usual side. The design side is always more challenging than you ever think. And yeah, certainly we ran into some bugs, but we also got some great feedback from the community saying, wow, it'd be really cool if you could do this, if you improve that, if you also had that. So we spent a lot of time the past couple of months really refining the product. And I look at this almost as more of almost consumer-like with the features and functions, but it's really designed for two audiences. Because as you know, because you helped design a lot of the screens and the look of it, we've got a very basic mode for your more average consumer daily user. But then we got a pro mode for somebody that's a private investigator or TSCM, technical surveillance countermeasure, or somebody that does executive protection detail, things like that. So we've got customers more on the higher end and more basic consumers that are just nervous for hey, my wife's being stalked or tracked. I want a little device to make sure that there's no tags put in the car for more peace of mind, to somebody that's providing services to actually sweep vehicles. So we've got kind of two extremes. Any event, one of the first ones that shipped just recently was to a customer that does a lot of executive protection and technical surveillance countermeasures. And I'll just read it if it's okay here. I'm not disclosing anything, because this was public information. I just actually stumbled upon it on LinkedIn and I saw a picture of the units. This is great. What a nice compliment. It said, I added a new tool to the toolbox today. I have to say it's the best BLE tracking tool I have. Small, fast, and accurate. If you're on an executive protection detail, you need one of these. Slip it in your pocket and know right away if you're being tracked with a Bluetooth low energy device. Scott and team over at Berkeley have hit a home run with this one. Thank you, Scott, for making my job easier. I said, wow, that's great. What a nice little compliment. And to kind of see it, and it's unsolicited, and I didn't reach out and ask him to write this or see. I'm just checking in my LinkedIn feed as I normally do, and saw a picture of the unit, which caught my eye. And I'm like, hey, that's our unit. Next thing I know, I saw this nice little compliment that he put out to his community of people in the technical surveillance side and private investigators and stuff like that. So nice to see feedback from actual users out there. And I continue, I welcome that feedback, and not just good praise always. I welcome back good and bad, because I think one thing that we've learned being in business now, we're over 50 years, our customers are really our business. Their voice is what shapes our product and improves our product. we might have a decent idea, sometimes even a great idea, but it becomes superior when the customers give us that valuable feedback, little tweaks, how to make it better, the right color, the right way to scroll down a menu, or a unique feature that only our product has perhaps. And we try to embed those to make sure we're making the best products for our customer base that we can. So to me, that's the key. Listen to the customers. That's how you make great products. Not anything that you come up with necessarily. You might have some great ideas, but ultimately the customers really have to drive it.
Yeah, it's very easy to get stuck in a, you know, we're kind of a design engineering company. So it's very easy to get stuck in a bubble here in your own thoughts, your own head, and think your way is the only way or your way is the right way. And a lot of times there's more than one solution to a problem. And sometimes they're even more elegant from people that you wouldn't expect would know or you know, positive theory. So it's great to get this kind of feedback. You know, maybe, who knows, if we start shipping enough of these things, we get enough feedback, that could become our new segment on this podcast. You know, the Bluetooth like feedback for the week or whatever.
No, it does work. We're developing a new product. It's kind of at a cool stage right now. And I literally made a mock-up and I walked around the building over the past week and I handed it to random employees. And I said, what do you think? And I've got the most interesting feedback from some of them. Everything from, I don't like it, it's a dumb idea, too heavy, awkward, hurts my wrist, you know, and it's an integrated one-handed solution with direction finding tool for a new product we're launching, which is pretty hot. But in the process, I got three things from employees that to me were golden gems, little tiny tweaks that make it much better. And then one just today, in fact, started talking about, they said, you know, I bought these little mounts for a GoPro used for my motorcycle helmet to the camera. What about that to mount the unit to the handle, to the direction finder? And we started talking it out, and hence we got some samples coming in early next week. And I said, what's wrong with looking at how other people do things? Like GoPros probably spent millions of dollars perfecting their mounting brackets, ruggedized, lightweight, flexible, and integrate their accessories into some of our products. So I'm often a big champion of look at what other people have done really good and successfully. And I'm not one to say, let's just copy their idea, but rather use it. Give them the money. They're selling the bracket. They charge a dollar for it and you can buy it off the shelf. Just integrate something that's proven technology that works really good instead of trying to get into their business. We're not going to be making millions of camera mounts or anything like that, but here's somebody that really knows what they're doing, how to make the best one. Integrate it into your product to give your customers the best experience that you possibly can. Yeah, very good stuff.
Yep. Yeah. Let's get into the first story, but before we do, just want to mention that our this week's sponsor is Dark Kryptonite, and they stop ransomware, malware, and phishing in their tracks, eliminating cybercrime, fraud, and info warfare. They use the advanced blockchain algorithms and zero trust models to accomplish this. But I think you get a better sense if you go on their website and see for yourself. They just updated it, I think. More information on there now. There might even be a mention of us somewhere on there. Go to darkkryptonite.com. Kryptonite is with a C, like crypto. Okay, first story. This one comes to us from bleepingcomputer.com. And 8 million people hit by data breach at U.S. government contractor Maximus. Never heard of Maximus, but apparently, they're one of many, many contractors that our government uses. And this one specifically was a zero-day flaw in a MOVEit file transfer application. MOVEit, it must be a brand of file transfer applications. WeTransfer. I know that one I use sometimes. Mm-hmm. There's Fetchit and all that kind of stuff out there. So many of those things. And I guess when you get a zero-day flaw, you can move in and grab a lot of information, because the nature of those applications is that you're sending a lot of information. And that doesn't help any matters. Looks like social security number, some protected health information, some personal information, that kind of stuff was possibly breached and scraped. I don't know if we, but it's eight. The headline says 8 million, but they claim 8 to 11 million.
Yeah.
In kind of the breakdown, I don't know if you remember. This reminds me a little bit of the what is it? The OPM. The
yes.
We did a chapter about that in our book. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Scott? On a scale of like, let's say OPM is the worst case. Where does this fall on that scale? How bad do you think this sounds?
Well, OPM was pretty bad. I mean, that would probably be in a higher level. You know, if it was a 0 to 10, 10 being the worst, I'd put OPM at like 11. It was so bad. And that was over 22 million records, the OPM breach. And that goes again back in 2015. And we wrote about it in the book, sometime later. But those records were a little different because they were specific to government employees that went under background checks. And so it tied to them, their immediate family, and their closest friends. And it was fingerprints and a whole bunch of other things beside the normal name, social security address, phone number compromise. So the OPM one was about double the size of this one, but to me, more personal information. And that's what made that one really stand out. Whereas if you look at what Maximus does, and we deal with a lot of these government contractors one way or another through some of the products that we do sell, but not really Maximus specific. In this particular case, they focus their core is really tied to Medicaid, Medicare, healthcare reform, welfare, student loan services, a couple other select government programs. So it's kind of a niche that they work with government programs and contracts. So yes, it does have personal information because, again, especially tied to that, I call it the healthcare type of sector, because healthcare breaches and healthcare type of scams are very lucrative. You know, identity theft, you can make a certain amount, but if you're doing falsified claims for insurance and things like that, and you need different codes and personal information for people, there's a lot of fraud going on in that sector, especially in that Medicaid and Medicare, the government just can't keep up with. So this is a very rich data set of stolen information, that 8 to 11 million people that they got. And that's probably how they're going to really make money on it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll keep an eye out. I just noticed looking at the stories, maybe subconsciously, these are all the stories this week are all kind of, they involve government hacking, regulations, bill proposals, and all that kind of thing. So we have a U.S. government-themed news story feed this week, I suppose. Let's jump into the next story. Before we do, just want to quickly mention once again, Dark Kryptonite. If you believe your email address might be appearing on the dark web, you might want to contact Dark Kryptonite because they do all those kinds of forensics, looking all over the dark web, finding where stolen passwords and credentials are that might relate directly back to you. So I would contact darkkryptonite.com for more information, find out about all their services. New SEC rules requires U.S. companies to reveal cyber attacks within 4 days. We've heard about this for years. More transparency is needed, things like that. It seems that the U.S., compared to other countries, is pretty conservative about this stuff, though. You know, four days. Meanwhile, the EU, UK, Canada, South Africa, Australia, they have a 72-hour maximum window when a cyber incident needs to be reported. And in the East, China and Singapore, it's only 24 hours. And India is only 6 hours. So they're very they're very strict about that kind of stuff. I don't know. Do you think it is 4-day? I understand a lot of it is due to, well, okay, here's the thing. And part of the wording of it is it's one of these devils in the details, because they say cyber attack within 4 days of identifying that it has a material impact on their finances. So that the criteria is kind of set by the company itself, which doesn't seem fair. That could be very biased. And also they're setting the terms, you know, material impact. You know, what does that mean? That means different things to different companies, to different people. And I'm sure your CFO and your CISO are going to say, it's a material impact. We can't reveal this for a month at least, you know. And you think, in 4 days might be too much. The damage might be already done, and more damage could be inflicted to other vendors and other companies as a result of withholding this information. What do you think is this a one size fits all, or we're just going to have to take it for now, I guess, 4 days for U.S. companies?
Yeah, I guess I'm not 100% sure. And I do think no one size doesn't fit all is not always, you know, it's probably a good way to say it, because you think about it, imagine it's a large banking institution with, you know, tens of thousands of employees. That's very different than a small business that's got 20 employees. You know, they may have a cyber department with 50 people. Your company may have no cyber department. So it's certainly going to vary greatly. It almost needs to be that they have to distinguish between small, medium, and large size business versus enterprise, or kind of put some classifications in there, because that's a little bit more realistic based upon what time you should respond. A lot of it too is you should have to really contact the government and share with them that you believe there's a breach. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to go public all the time and tell everybody, because they may tell you, keep quiet about it. Hey, we're going to help you negotiate a ransomware settlement, or we have a company coming in that can do some forensics about this. I think this generally is really talking about publicly traded companies there, which are generally larger companies, to be on the stock exchange and so on and so forth. You got to spend a lot of money to stay listed and all. So I can understand maybe 4 days, maybe that makes a lot of sense there. But maybe to add to it, I think to your point before, you made an interesting point. I just wanted to piggyback on it. These stories talk all about government and data breaches, which I think is interesting. If you follow some of the other headlines that recently came out, and it's really been the past month or so, there's been a lot of talk about U.S. Cyber Force. This is going to be a new U.S. military segment that's going to grow very quickly. And this is akin to the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Space Force, which is a newer one that came up in the past few years. Now there's going to be a cyber force, U.S. cyber force. And what does that tell you? It tells you there's that many problems. I'm just making a general blanket statement without giving away things or saying anything specific, but the U.S. government's dealing with a lot of cyber issues, a lot of breaches, and they're helping a lot of companies at different levels to prevent catastrophe. And they said that the budget for this U.S. the proposed budget for U.S. cyber force is close to $1 trillion that they're planning on handing over. $1 trillion to start out. That is a huge amount of money, and perhaps that is why we've seen with our business. And again, we focus Berkeley Veritronics, making a plug here. We make wireless threat detection tools, and we do sell to many government agencies to keep things safe and stop cyber threats, usually when it's a wireless conduit. And that's why we've seen increase in spending. And looking forward, I see a lot of this too, because there's so many problems. There are so many problems, different government sectors being targeted and attacked, critical infrastructure, and the government helping different sectors of the business world to remediate these things. And CISA, that division's been doing a lot. They've been very active in the space, and I think doing a lot of good between educating, raising awareness, sharing a lot of things, tips and things for businesses to be proactive and not become victims. So a lot has been done just in the past year, and I think a lot more based upon how much money is going to be spent in the world of cyber. So I think in the next few years, the U.S. is probably going to come out of it as far as a country that is going to have a very strong defense protecting everything and anything to do with cyber.
Yeah, and you mentioned cyber force. And if you just look at who's implementing these rules, it's not a security company, it's the SEC, which yes. They really have a, you know, they care about finances. And yes, you want your financial transactions to be secure. But you know how we always say, don't build your product or don't build your company with cybersecurity as an afterthought. Build it from the foundation. And I think this is more of a SEC kind of latching on to, hey, let's add some security rules. They're not going to redo their entire institution. It doesn't sound like they're forming some kind of big panel of experts to decide on the fair use of these rules. And they're certainly not commissioning Cyberforce to implement these rules. They're doing it themselves. So it might not be a fully secure measure, and maybe eventually they will hand off some of this to something like a Cyberforce or something that's hopefully a non-biased entity that has an expertise in security, and, you know, specifically the security of bits and bytes. That just jumps to my head, and that it's the same old thing. Like let's throw some security into the mix and call it a day, and hopefully that will fix the problem. And you know, we'll see. Maybe 4 days is enough. Maybe the rules that the transparency complies with are enough. I guess we'll see how that works out for these publicly traded companies and the economy as a whole.
Yeah, but I do think if they don't do something, then nothing gets done. Without putting mm-hmm. some pressure or specificity on reporting times or other things, you got to have some realistic rules that will make people, make companies, make business leaders, especially these publicly traded companies, they got to respond. Because in the past, too many of them buried their head. And we wrote about some of these with Uber and the likes. And when they were hacked, they covered it up by calling it a bug bounty when it was really a ransomware payment, and other creative accounting measures companies have done, publicly traded companies. And it doesn't fly anymore. They have to be accountable because they have to answer to the public, their shareholders and their customers. So I'm glad they're putting some rules and regulations in to make things more transparent. That's really the bottom line.
Yeah. Our next story, before I get to it, just want to remind listeners one more time, Dark Kryptonite stops ransomware, malware, and phishing in their track, eliminating cybercrime, fraud, and info warfare. And they do that by utilizing blockchain algorithms and zero trust models. And you can learn more on darkkryptonite.com, kryptonite with a C. Let's see, this next story is really a true story about the government, because of it comes from thehill.com, which is mm-hmm. pretty much only political stories. Mm-hmm. And it's called Putting a Price on Privacy, Ending Police Data Purchases. So it's not a law that's been passed already. Nothing has changed yet. It's a proposal. It's the the Fourth Amendment Is Not For Sale Act. They always try to come up with these catchy, stupid proposals, but I guess they couldn't make an acronym out of this one. So it's just the Fourth Amendment Is Not For Sale Act. That's a new bill. And I guess what it's generally trying to do is prevent people from prevent citizens from being tracked or suspects from being tracked through the use of data brokering, which is essentially a workaround for legal warrant that law enforcement are supposed to use. So you got these cops saying, well, either we don't think we're going to get the warrant because it's not justified, or it's going to take too long, or whatever. And if you pay a fee to the right data broker, they'll say, well, we have information on this suspect's phone. They were, you know, here's all their metadata. Now, you're not getting end-to-end encryption information, but a lot of times you don't need that information. All you need to do to prove that someone is could be in the vicinity of a suspect at the time, or kind of guilt by association data, is this metadata. It's geolocation isn't just being used for military operations, but rather to track crimes as mundane as tax evasion, border protection, immigrant and customs enforcement. So you got a lot of different government mm-hmm. branches using this kind of metadata. So they really are getting around the Fourth Amendment by paying a fee. And you really shouldn't be able, I guess that's the thing about the Constitution and the amendments. There shouldn't be any price that can be paid to get around them, because that's kind of the point of them. They're supposed to be sacrosanct, and it's the rule of law and all those things. I don't know, what do you think about this bill and this issue?
Well, I do think this is a little bit of a challenging one, because it crosses into the world, as you started out nicely saying, this is kind of political. So everybody's going to have a strong opinion on it this way or that way. I mean, from my perspective, again, non-political view, because I'm kind of neutral, but I am neutral, I should say. But I look at it this way. I like privacy. We all like privacy, and we deserve a level of privacy in the country that we live in, even though you're in a different country right at the moment. But there's a perceived and expected level of privacy. And clearly, with the laws in place and all the loopholes, there's a workaround just about everybody has found, through social media, through apps, through tech, backdoors and other things, but we really do not have privacy. That being said, does that bother me? Sure, I want a level of privacy, but at the same time, I don't think it's fair to make it difficult for law enforcement and make it challenging so they can't do their job. It's kind of, I always think about it like you ask a police officer to risk their life to protect you, and you're giving a cop a gun with no bullets, almost, because they have cameras that watch the police and rules they have to follow, but the bad guys do whatever they want. So I think there has to be some balance, some transparency between the two. And the same thing here. Should police be able to just throw money at it and get data and work around it? No, that's not right. But they should have reasonable methods to obtain data, be it when there's they go to a judge and they get a warrant and so on and so forth. They do things through the legal proper channels that are in place to get data so they could catch bad guys and keep us safer. I don't have any problem with that. Even if it may, to some degree, compromise a little bit of my privacy. Everybody's going to have a difference of opinion on this one. It's only going to get worse before it gets better, in my opinion, because the bottom line is we are all more connected than we ever were before. Years ago, I didn't have a connected thermostat that I do now. I didn't have a video doorbell that I do now. I didn't have a smartphone that has access to a family plan connected in with all my other smartphones and cameras and so on and so forth. The list expands. If you look at your life and your IoT devices and how wide your footprint is, your digital footprint, you really don't have much privacy anymore for a true hacker or bad guy if they want to go after you. You have to basically throw the electronics, throw everything wireless in the garbage to stay safe and stay off the grid, or to some degree, your data is out there, bottom line.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I'm not a privacy absolutist, and I'm not a security absolutist. I think in the real world, we live in the middle, in that gray area, and you're always pushing, some groups on, that tend to live on one side more than the other side of that scale, or pushing one way and the other group is pushing the other way. And you got to live in that happy medium. It just reminds me of an analogy I hear often on, I listen to a lot of geek tech and security podcasts, and they always talk about the people on the privacy side always kind of complain that, they say, well, with the advent of smartphones and all of this data, law enforcement has more access legally, illegally, however they're getting it, they have more access to information on everyone than they had in, you know, than they've ever had in history, you know, 100 times more than just probably in the past 30 years, just because of the smartphone alone. And they always liken it to a surveillance video where you have it like you're looking at an HD TV and you have all, you know, these millions of pixels on this TV. And so you're seeing all these kind of pixels of data, and there's just one pixel that's dead. And that's the law enforcement is, you know, crying and complaining and trying to get the rules changed because of that one. They want that one pixel to light up for them so they could see a whole picture. You know, they, in a sense, usually that's usually the, you know, let's decrypt end-to-end encryption, because that would be kind of a major score for law enforcement. They would get conversations, they would get motives, they would get everything they need to make for a solid case. But there would also be many unintended and intended consequences that come of that. I think where you'd have citizens that are innocent would get caught up in this dragnet, and then what happens when the law changes and suddenly they go back and say, hey, wait, you did this, you said this, you were consorting with this person at that time, and we change, you know, the laws have changed, and so now we're going to prosecute you because we can prove that you did this. And, you know, it digs up so many things when you want that absolutist security, you know, law and order state. That those are the concerns, and you know, likewise the absolute privacy state. Well, I think it's a thing of fiction, because no one is truly off the grid. Even if you are off the grid, you're still on a grid that can be tracked by someone. And if someone wants to track you enough and, you know, charge you with a crime and investigate and all those things, they can do it. It doesn't matter where you live or, you know, it doesn't matter how many cell phones you smash and how many SIM cards you remove and batteries you remove. Mm-hmm. You can still be tracked through so many other methods. So,
yeah,
I think both extremes are wrong. And, you know, it comes back to just kind of trying to live somewhere in that happy medium.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely truth in that. And I was thinking just the other day, I was actually assisting a ongoing investigation that entailed some surveillance footage. And it was interesting because they brought in a cyber forensics expert. And while we were doing some things, just waiting for some footage to be downloaded, we were just chatting about some war stories and crazy things, this and that. And I clearly saw his expertise. He has to constantly, in law enforcement, stay up to the latest and greatest education on cyber crimes and hackers and threats. But his sheer frustration dealing with large tech companies that just basically make blanket statements and prevent law enforcement from having access to a lot of things. So they have to get creative and work with other companies to find back doors and exceptions to just collect data and use it to prosecute the bad guys. And I thought it was very interesting hearing it from that perspective, the law enforcement, and I felt really bad. And I said, wow, you're trying to do your job and do good things to keep people safe, yet you have a lot of roadblocks and a lot of challenges. And on top of all that, now you have the technical challenges and hurdles. It's true what you said. There are a lot more access to electronic things, but there's a lot of locked doors that they run into in the process. So things that you would think are very simple to do become very expensive and very time consuming and tie up the legal system for getting basic evidence to use against bad guys for doing things that are just wrong. So there's got to be some checks and balances, I think, put in place to streamline some of that, that would allow, I would think, law enforcement to fast track and have access to the rich data sets that are out there so they can actually solve a crime and take care of something. I think that's important. I was thinking back a number of years ago, you may remember the story. We're in a industrial park and the companies have since moved out, but across the street, there were two very large buildings and they received huge spools of copper wire out from the Midwest. And these were giant spools that weighed, you know, several tons. And they put them on big machines that would spool them down to smaller spools of, you know, 25, 50, 100 foot lengths. And this was for mostly industrial wiring and some home wiring. They sold to Home Depot, Lowe's, and all the other big box stores. Well, they had a problem that an employee was, or they didn't know it was an employee or inside job, outside job combination of the two, or physical break-in. They didn't know what was going on, but copper just kept disappearing. Wire, tons and tons of it were disappearing. Day in, week out, month out. And this went on for over the course of a year. And then finally, they installed a whole bunch of cameras in the building to see, okay, maybe it was employees stealing it somehow, covering up the sky. Couldn't find any trace evidence of it. They called the police. The police came, and then they said, you know what? I noticed there's cameras at the building across the street, and we've got a pretty nice camera system and DVR and recorder also and so forth. And the police came over and said, hey, do you guys have cameras facing our building in the street? And I said, yeah, sure. Could we come in and look? We have a scenario where large volume of copper wire has been stolen over the past year. We have no idea where, why, how. Can we look at your footage? Sure. So we sat there, and it took a while. We went through about an hour or so of scrolling through different days when they had marks, when things were stolen. And guess what? Sure enough, they saw a white pickup truck going in about 1 a.m. And then sometime later, 2 a.m. or something like that, it would drive out and it was filled with copper wire. And they're like, what? How'd they do that? They didn't get in the building. Well, what the guys did, it was an inside job. They drilled a hole in the building. They set these giant spools up right before they left work, and they would stick a little feeder outside the building. It was a hole. And they basically would pull up to the building and just start pulling. They'd be pulling until they would empty the reel, cut it, fill the truck up. Next morning, go to the recycler and cash in and make thousands of dollars every morning. And this went on for, I think, the course of almost a year. But the videotape footage, that data, that rich set of data, putting things together with the timestamps, the video, the license plate, the pickup truck, figuring out who the employee was, allowed them to arrest them. And it was fascinating just to be part of it and to see that the valuable use of timestamps in just video, and we were just videotaping the traffic in our parking lot and other things, really hasn't proven very useful for us, but how it aided in the arrest of a criminal across the street was very eye-opening to me. So I always applaud people when they do set up video cameras, not to spy on people and things, but just to protect yourself, because you don't know what might happen or when you might use that as evidence for something to keep you or your loved one safe.
Yeah, that reminds me of the, there's a great documentary. I wish I could remember exactly what it was called. It's on Netflix and it's fairly new. It's all about the Boston bombing.
I heard about that. I didn't see it yet.
It's got, you know, it's like, just like what you were saying, how when you set up a security camera for your own premises, it doesn't usually benefit you. It ends up benefiting others because that's how they saw the guys and tracked them, and they used multiple cameras and they recreated the whole scenario. And it was fascinating, just the forensics that went behind it when you put, and they got lucky too. There was a lot of lucky breaks that made it possible, but there was also a lot of great detective work. And so when you put all those things together, you know, you end up getting the result. They nabbed the two guys within days, and it's kind of an amazing story, the whole thing.
That's fabulous.
Another thing that just reminded me, you were talking before about the customer kind of hitting these legal roadblocks and things. I get this email newsletter. I'm not going to say who it's from. I don't want to give them a free plug because I don't know anything about them. But it's a newsletter for law enforcement, and it's training classes. And they specifically target, they have, I'll read this real quick, Apple and Google search warrants. So they say how to get, you know, the best way to kind of lubricate the system so that you can get a search warrant so that Apple and Google and other major companies will, you know, disclose comply be forced to disclose this information on a suspect. They have a specific class for Snapchat investigations. they have one for general, like just social media investigations. Snapchat investigations. This course is intended for all law enforcement officers with an interest in social media investigations and will focus on Snapchat, relevant to patrol officers, street crime team members, and investigators working in assignments related to narcotics, firearms, gangs, sex crimes, and violent crimes. So the tools are out there. All we can hope for is that the tools are being used in a legal way and properly. And I have no problem with that. It's the, you know, the guys who try to skirt the law and, you know, contaminate the chain of evidence and then cover it up and lie about it so that, you know, they can make their case and those kind of things. Those are, you know, problematic. But, you know, more knowledge and more tools used in a legal way is good for everyone, I think.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. And I think technology is always going to be misused, unfortunately, by the bad guys. But I think at the same time, it's important to embrace technology for good purposes and to be used for lawful things to stop the bad guys from abusing things. And I do see that it typically the good guys tend to be a little bit lax in the training and knowledge base, and focus more on maybe gut or instincts or old school techniques that they've used that have worked for years. But unfortunately, things change too quick. I mean, just keeping up with social media and trying to manage accounts and understanding how they all work is very, very cumbersome and very time distracting. And you need experts in the field now to assist law enforcement, I think, to make their job easier so they can get the information they need so they can do their job properly. And I support it wholeheartedly. I think it's key these days.
Yeah, there is. Well, that about wraps up the stories for this episode. Before we go, just want to check in with you and see what you got coming up. I think you got a big show coming up next week, right?
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm going to be heading out to Vegas for a couple days, heading out Tuesday night. I'm going to be with Cybercrime Magazine and doing some exciting interviews there with some CISOs and others in the cyber community at Black Hat in Las Vegas for 2 days. I know I'll be interviewing some really exciting people, so certainly stay tuned and listen on Cybercrime Magazine and Cybercrime Radio. They host a lot of these episodes that I'm doing, and some great stuff. Black Hat is always an exciting event. It's a little different, a little more cutting edge, maybe than RSA. Is a little more, I call it business minded individuals, a little more polished. Black Hat's a little more edgy, perhaps, for obvious reasons. And I think that this year too, it may be a little bit, little different also with just the recent passing of Kevin Mitnick. Certainly many people are going to be talking about him. And I think that the good that he's certainly done for the hacking community and the education side, going from, I guess, a black hat to a white hat hacker and really educating and devoting his life to helping people, certainly was a sad loss with him passing. And I know I've learned personally many things from him, reading his books. Just, I remember kicking back one time and just having a drink with them after an event. And we talked for hours about stuff. We just had such a good time trading stories and jokes and things that we reflected back from when we were both children doing things, him on the phone freaking side. And I thought about, I was sharing stuff when we were younger with hacking games, Atari and Apple and all the different crazy antics that we used to do as a, you know, on the bulletin board systems and the PSYOPs and hacking through the password.
He was closer to your age, right?
Yes, he was. Yeah. I think he's 59. So he was about 5-6 years older than myself, but we really connected and hit it off there with a lot of commonalities and stories. And I think also growing up, knowing a lot of the people that were influential in our times that were also into that kind of scene was interesting to just chat about and talk with them. So I always have fond reflections when I think back to some of those conversations I had. And it was wonderful because I had the privilege of interviewing them on a few occasions as well, and different trade shows and events, and just getting his perspective. And of course, he worked at No Before and had great success there with the founder, Stu. And they've done some great things with, I think, their phishing awareness and other types of awareness training to keep people safe in the world of cyber. And they've done a fair amount over the years. So I highly respect certainly the things that they've done from an educational standpoint as well.
Yeah. Right. Well, I wouldn't be surprised that there's some sort of memorial or you know, gathering remembrance of Kevin Mitnick at the Black Hat. We'll see. Yeah. But in the meantime, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Dark Kryptonite, once again, for stopping ransomware, malware, and phishing in their tracks by eliminating cybercrime, fraud, and information warfare. They use advanced blockchain algorithms and zero trust models to accomplish this, and you can learn all about it on darkkryptonite.com. This podcast is available on YouTube, Spotify, Google, iHeart, Apple, Amazon, and more. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and review our podcast. For questions and comments, you can contact us at linktree.com/Scott Schober. You get all his social media things. He's kind of the point of contact for this podcast. We read your comment or question on the podcast. We'll send you a choice of a signed copy of Hacked Again, Cybersecurity is Everybody's Business, or Senior Cyber. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for another episode of Cyber Coast to Coast. This is Craig signing off from Costa Rica.
All right. Take care there, Craig. Talk to you soon. And this is Scott, co-host, signing off from the East Coast here out of Metuchen, New Jersey. Stay safe, everyone.
Coast to coast, with your hosts Scott and Craig Schober.